Today is Wednesday, July 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The Democrat-led House Select Committee investigating the January 6th riot at the Capitol building hears firsthand testimony from officers who are on the scene.
During those moments, I remember thinking there was a very good chance I would be torn apart or shot to death with my own weapon.
Plus, scientists warn that Britain risks becoming a breeding ground for new variants of the coronavirus that could be resistant to vaccines. These stories and more next. On Tuesday, four U.S. police officers told a congressional investigating committee in tearful, gripping detail how an angry mob of supporters of then-President Donald Trump rampaged into the U.S. Capitol building last January 6th in a futile attempt to block certification of Democrat Joe Biden's victory in last November's presidential election. Democrat Representative Benny Thompson is the chair of the select committee and told the American public that their actions would be guided by the facts of the day.
The facts of what happened on January 6th in the run up to that tragic day and what has taken place since. That's what we're charged to do by House Resolution 503. There's no place for politics or partisanship in this investigation.
Liz Cheney, one of two Republicans appointed to the committee, added that members of Congress and the American people must know what happened at the Capitol on that day.
We must also know what happened every minute of that day in the White House. Every phone call, every conversation, every meeting leading up to, during, and after the attack. Honorable men and women have an obligation to step forward.
During questioning, Capitol Police Sergeant Aquilino Gonell likened the assault on the Capitol building to that of a medieval battle.
We fought hand to hand, inch by inch, to prevent an invasion of the Capitol by a violent mob intent on subverting our democratic process. My fellow officers and I were committed to not letting any rioters breach the Capitol. It was a prolonged and desperate struggle. The rioters attempted to breach the Capitol were shouting, "Trump, send us. Pick the right side. We want Trump."
And Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police Department officer Michael Fanone recounted his harrowing experience with the rioters.
At some point during the fighting, I was dragged from the line of officers and into the crowd. I heard someone scream, "I got one." As I was swarmed by a violent mob, they ripped off my badge. They grabbed and stripped me of my radio. They seized ammunition that was secured to my body. They began to beat me with their fists and with what felt like hard metal objects. At one point, I came face to face with an attacker who repeatedly lunged for me and attempted to remove my firearm. I heard chanting from some in the crowd, "Get his gun and kill him with his own gun." I was aware enough to recognize I was at risk of being stripped of and killed with my own firearm. I was electrocuted again and again and again with a taser. I'm sure I was screaming, but I don't think I could even hear my own voice. My body camera captured the violence of the crowd directed toward me during those very frightening moments. It's an important part of the record for this committee's investigation and for the country's understanding of how I was assaulted and nearly killed as the mob attacked the Capitol that day. And I hope that everyone will be able to watch it. The portions of the video I've seen remain extremely painful for me to watch at times, but it is essential that everyone understands what really happened that tragic day. During those moments, I remember thinking there was a very good chance I would be torn apart or shot to death with my own weapon.
Republican leaders maintain that the riot is being adequately investigated by law enforcement agencies and other congressional committees. They argue that the latest investigation is simply a political exercise designed to cast the Republican Party in a poor light ahead of midterm elections next year. In the weeks ahead, the investigative panel could subpoena numerous witnesses, possibly including Trump, to testify about what they knew ahead of the confrontation as well as it was unfolding. With the first full day of testimony complete, I spoke with Craig Albert, a political science professor at Augusta University in Georgia, and I began our conversation by asking him what challenges the committee faces moving forward.
It's going to be hard to get buy-in, especially perhaps from center-right independents and for most of the Republican Party, because it doesn't have, you know, mainstream Republicans on it. It has the two Republicans that seem to be anti-Trump. The Republican Party is pretty much casting them out, so it doesn't seem to be bipartisan. Of course, that is not the fault of the House committee itself. That's the fault of the Republican House Minority Leader saying, do not participate in this. So the fact that the public won't buy it is something that I think the Republicans meant to do, so it doesn't come off as being a bipartisan select committee. So the results of that then will be questioned by Republicans and therefore by the Republicans in Congress and therefore by the Republicans in the electorate, period.
Do you think that they really won't buy it? Because this is a hearing that is going to be broadcast on C-SPAN, which covers a lot of the congressional hearings. It's going to be carried by the major networks in the United States. And as Republicans and Democrats on the committee said, this is an investigation to seek the truth rather than play politics. But in your opinion, is it because there aren't Republicans nominated by the minority in the House? Republicans at large are going to, you know, dismiss whatever findings they come up with, because you mentioned even the center right Republicans rather than, you know, what some political analysts call the core Trump base of the Republican Party. You know, it's understandable that they may not buy the results, but even the center right, the more centrist members of the party.
That's right. And I think this is pointing towards a larger issue in politics right now, is that we're kind of in a post-truth age. So everything, things that should be explained by basic investigatory journalism or you know, explanatory powers of Congress, which is the purpose of the Select Committee, right, is to investigate and seek out kind of like a fact-based report at the end of it so that patterns can be had and predictions made for how to handle future policy things like this. That's not the world we live in right now. We seem to live in a world, and I'm not casting blame on one side here, but it seems to be, you know, pick an issue and either the left or the right seems to disregard what should be simple facts or truth, as, you know, they label it as partisan politics. And for the January 6th investigation, it seems like most Republicans seem to be downplaying it and seem to be saying that it's partisan politics and that it wasn't as bad. The events of January 6th were not as bad as what the left or center left folks are making it out to be. And that's unfortunate because, you know, by all standard definitions, it is a riot, a rebellion, an insurrection. And if you look at the code for domestic terrorism, based on what you think the reasons for the incidents to occur, it could be labeled very clearly as domestic terrorism. But because we live in what, you know, many are calling this post-truth age, where truth itself becomes a partisan issue, there's going to be no real new truth laid out by the Select Committee, right? That most of the videos have been shown before. They did show one new one today, but there was no new damaging evidence in that video. Was pretty much as horrific as all the videos have been, right? So if one's mind has not been made up yet as a Republican about the seriousness of January 6th, I don't think this committee is going to achieve that.
One last question. Going back to your earlier comments, it really sounded as if you do not believe that the hearing will largely impact the way that Democrats and Republicans look at January 6th. 2022 is a midterm election called by-elections in other countries. Do you have any inclination as to whether or not this committee will have an impact on the 2022 elections that will see, you know, who retains the majority in the House of Representatives?
I think so. And the Republican Party is still split, you know, very heavily between pro-Trump and more mainstream or anti-Trump, especially with that the Republican Accountability Project. If you're familiar with them. So they're really trying to up their marketing game and attract former Trumpers to their mainstream. And that could influence the elections a lot. Trump is still a viable political force, right? And if the Select Committee can show anything damaging about Trump or Trump's handling of this, And some of those folks that are still hanging on Trump as the leader of the Republican Party might back down and back away from that by the 2022 midterms, and therefore might allow the Democrats to maintain the House, if not increase it, and maybe even increase the Senate lead as well. So I think that's something that's important to keep in mind about this.
That was Augusta University political science professor Craig Albert. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. The United States Center for Disease Control and Prevention has updated its guidance on mask wearing. Associated Press correspondent Shelley Adler has those details.
CDC Director Rochelle Walensky says scientists have new information about the ability of the Delta variant to spread among vaccinated people. So mask guidance is changing.
In areas with substantial and high transmission, CDC recommends fully vaccinated people wear masks in public indoor settings to help prevent the spread of the Delta variant and protect others.
Schools are also included in that mask recommendation. With an average of more than 57,000 cases a day, the latest surge is mostly affecting the unvaccinated.
With the Delta variant, vaccinating more Americans now is more urgent than ever.
I'm Shelley Adler.
Some scientists warn that Britain risks becoming a breeding ground for new variants of the coronavirus that could be resistant to vaccines. Henry Ridgewell has that part of our story.
Three, two, one.
For 16 months, nightclubs were silenced by the pandemic. They reopened July 19th as Britain celebrated so-called Freedom Day. For the young, a chance to forget the misery of lockdown.
We've been the last ones to get the vaccine. We've always been the blame. We've been the blame for the spread of the COVID. And it's just nice to get freedom and kind of, like, brush it all off.
But scientists warn those freedoms bring added dangers. Emilia Skirmund is an evolutionary virologist at the University of Oxford.
I think that there will be more infections than we've seen in the last days. More infections, there is bigger chance that we will see new variant, which might be even more infectious.
Britain has rolled out one of the fastest vaccination programs in the world. Just over 70% of adults are fully vaccinated. But unlike in the United States and parts of Europe, under-18s haven't been offered the vaccine. Again, Emilia Skirmund.
If we have groups which are unvaccinated, they are they're the danger that the variant, which might be more infectious or better at evading our immune response, will appear there. Teenagers and children are unvaccinated, and the new variant might appear among them.
Some scientists warn the combination of high infection rates and incomplete vaccination programs pose considerable dangers. Sergios Mostios is from the University of Northumbria.
It is creating the most perfect, fertile ground for the virus, these variants that are present now, to evolve resistance to the vaccine.
So far, British government scientists say there is no evidence that the virus is becoming more resistant to vaccines. And as more people are vaccinated, total infections should decrease, reducing the scope for the virus to mutate. Meanwhile, Britain has one of the world's most advanced genome sequencing programs, so it can quickly identify any new variants of concern. Head of the UK coronavirus genome sequencing program, Sharon Peacock.
The key thing we need to look out for, actually, is not just a new variant emerging, a brand new variant emerging, but actually Delta changing to have increasing biological characteristics that could lead to more spread or to increased immune evasion.
14% of the global population is fully vaccinated against the coronavirus, but just 1.1% of people in low-income countries have received a single dose. Again, Emilia Skirmund of the University of Oxford.
We need the whole world being vaccinated or having immunity on a certain level. And if only some countries will be vaccinated on that level, that wouldn't give us this global safety net.
As long as large populations remain unvaccinated, scientists say the coronavirus will continue to pose a risk to the whole world. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
As the conflict in Ethiopia's Tigray region spreads, the National Army and regional states are urging young people to join the fight against Tigrayan forces. The country's defense minister attended a handover of new recruits in the capital of Addis Ababa, where Gemma DeWaite reports.
Recruitment and support for Ethiopia's National Defense Forces has boomed in recent weeks. As the conflict among three regions of northern Ethiopia intensifies, several regional administrations are contributing fighters from their militia and the police reserves. Local administrations are also calling on youths to join the Ethiopian military and fight Tigrayan People's Liberation Front forces, which are labeled as terrorists by the country's parliament. Local administration officials from four districts of Oromia region told VOA that they have registered over 10,000 youths whom are now enrolled in military training. An official ceremony was held Tuesday in Addis Ababa as the recruits prepared to go to training camps. Kanaya Deta is Ethiopia's Minister of Defense. He says the TPLF has committed several atrocities on Ethiopians. He says it has also been creating division among Ethiopians. It is an anti-peace lament. Not only that, it is the group that led the attack of the Ethiopian army that has been protecting the nation. Moreover, he says, now it is colluding with the foreign entities to disintegrate Ethiopia. But he says that will not be accomplished. The minister also accepted donations for Ethiopian defense forces during the ceremony. The Amhara region has also called on residents of the region to join what it calls the mission of fighting the TPLF. Speaking on the regional TV station Saturday, Amhara Regional President Agenyo Tshagar called on every resident owning a rifle to defend the region. He says, we need to ask ourselves what is expected of us to stand against an enemy that wants to eradicate us from the face of the earth. That is why I'm calling on the residents now. He says he wants everyone who has state-owned rifles, members of the national militia, every individual owning a gun and all users in the region to go to local administration in their area and join the anti-TPLF mission. Agenyo also revealed that TPLF forces are engaging across Raya, Tlemt, Wag and Welkait areas where there has been a border dispute between Amhara and Tigray for years. He said regional security forces are fighting the TPLF forces together with the Ethiopian National Defense Forces. It is days after neighboring Afar region did the same that the Amhara joined. Last Friday, Awol Arba, the Afar regional president called on residents to raise their rifle against the TPLF. Also last week, the Afar region communications office told VOA that over 54,000 people have fled their homes due to the clashes with Tigrayan forces. Ethiopia announced a unilateral ceasefire in Tigray at the end of June. Since then, the TPLF has controlled the region's capital and made gains towards southern Tigray. Regional Tigray officials in the city of Mekele say that they have arrested thousands of Ethiopian soldiers, a claim that officials in Addis Ababa dismiss. But on July 18, the TPLF officials announced the release of over 1,000 low-ranking Ethiopian soldiers. Speaking to Reuters last week, Debretsion Gebremichael, the leader of Tigray People's Liberation Front, said, yet there are more than 5,000 Ethiopian soldiers with them, and they will keep the senior officers who will face the trial. The UN and several international human rights organizations have warned that the conflict has created a human rights catastrophe and that its spread will worsen the situation. The United Nations Human Rights Council this month passed a resolution expressing concern about rights violation by all the parties to the conflict. There have been numerous reports of aid convoy being blocked or attacked as they try to carry food and supplies to the displaced. On Saturday, the Tigray Regional Council held its meeting for the first time since the recent conflict broke out. Debretsion Gebremichael said, though several unprecedented things happened in the region, now the struggle of the people of Tigray is paying off. Galmudawit, BOA News, Addis Ababa.
Moroccan authorities have arrested a Uyghur activist. The Chinese citizen had been in the North African country living in exile and was picked up after Interpol distributed a Chinese terrorism warrant. Activists fear that he'll be sent back to China and that the arrest is part of a broader Chinese campaign to hunt down perceived dissidents outside its borders. Interpol and the Chinese embassy did not immediately comment. A fraud and embezzlement trial involving mismanagement of the Pope's investments has begun. There are 10 defendants standing trial, including a once powerful cardinal who Pope Francis fired from a top position. The trial is the result of a two-year investigation into a failed investment of more than $400 million into the London property market. The accused face prison sentences, fines, or both if convicted. The trial resumes October 5th. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has been stripped of Ecuadorian citizenship. Assange, who is Australian and currently in a British prison, was notified by Ecuador's judiciary. The Associated Press reports that Ecuadorian authorities say Assange's naturalization letter had multiple inconsistencies, different signatures, the possible alteration of documents, and unpaid fees. Assange's lawyer says that he will file an appeal. At least two people are dead after an explosion at an industrial park for chemical companies near Cologne, Germany. Some 31 people have been reported injured and several more are still reported missing. The explosion sent a black plume into the sky and took firefighters almost 4 hours to extinguish a subsequent fire. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Tunisia's Islamist al-Nakhda Party is calling President Kais Saied's suspension of parliament a coup and urging a broad dialogue, while other political parties and leaders appear divided on his decision. A number of trade syndicates, including the Labour Federation, say they support the move so long as it does not last more than a month. Edward Uranian takes it from here.
Tunisian state TV reported that the situation inside the country was calm Tuesday following President Kais Saied's decision Sunday to suspend parliament. It said Tunisians were largely obeying a curfew that forbids more than three people from gathering in the streets during the night. Most government institutions, with the exception of security forces, interior ministry, and customs, were also suspended for several days. The president met with political and trade union leaders to discuss his next move amid calls by some for a well-defined roadmap. The Tunisian president told a roundtable Monday night that he had been patient for a long time, but that some provocateurs were trying to destroy government institutions from within. He asked for calm and urged citizens to avoid provocations. Democracy is important, he said, but the poor have no rights. Islamist parliament speaker Rashid al-Ghannouchi told supporters to suspend their protest in front of parliament to avoid bloodshed. His al-Nahda party called the president's suspension of parliament a coup, but urged all political parties to hold a dialogue. Peter Johnson, a former U.S. diplomat who now works in Tunisia, tells VOA that he doesn't see a clear-cut answer as to whether the president's move was legal or not.
I would say it's definitely a gray area. It's not really clear black or white, because this is something that Article 80 gives him the power as commander-in-chief of the military, the power of national security, of protecting the borders, of diplomacy. However, at the same time, that same section of the Constitution talks about his power to remove certain government officials, but not to completely suspend parliament.
Johnson points out that the Constitution also gives Parliament the right to remove the president with a two-thirds vote, so the president short-circuited a major check and balance. But he argues the Tunisian public seems broadly supportive of Saied's move so far.
The Tunisian people seem broadly supportive of it so far. I hear from of many, many friends and from seeing the celebrations in the streets that people were very frustrated by the stalemate and the inaction of this current government or this past government.
Fatih Al-Ayadi, a spokesman for the Islamist Al-Nahda party, told Qatar's Al Jazeera TV that the best way to avoid the threats to the country that President Saied says he is trying to prevent is a return to normal constitutional procedures and a return to democracy in the political process. Outspoken Tunisian Member of Parliament Abir Moussi applauded the president for sidelining the Al-Nahda party, while Oussam Khalifi of the Heart of Tunisia party thanked him for his wise leadership and for acting swiftly. The head of the Tunisian Workers' Party, however, claimed the president was misleading the people. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin on Tuesday discussed dampening China's aggression in Southeast Asia through what he called integrated deterrence. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb is traveling with the secretary, who spoke at the IISS Fullerton Lecture in Singapore.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin met with allies in Singapore as the first top Biden administration official to visit Southeast Asia. He spoke of a U.S. vision of, quote, integrated deterrence for the region, a plan to beef up U.S. military capabilities and improve allies' ability to work together in order to help discourage what many see as China's bullying behavior.
Integrated deterrence also means working with partners to deter coercion and aggression across the spectrum of conflict, including in the so-called gray zone, where the rights and livelihoods of the people in Southeast Asia are coming under stress.
Austin said Beijing's claim to the majority of the South China Sea encroaches on the sovereignty and basic rights afforded to Southeast Asian nations by international law. Chinese ships are accused of harassing fishermen inside the Philippine Exclusive Economic Zone and oil and gas developers off the coast of Malaysia and Vietnam, hindering their energy development. Despite the territorial claims of other nations, China has created hundreds of hectares of artificial islands in the resource-rich sea to bolster its claims. But while local allies are happy the United States is there to help, they're worried the two great powers might cause more problems as Washington and Beijing butt heads. Murray Hybert is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
There's a lot of anxiety that the high-level tensions now between China and the U.S. over so many issues, from Xinjiang, Hong Kong, Taiwan, South China Sea, that they're going to get caught. And so what they don't want is to be forced to choose.
Austin said the Biden administration is not asking regional allies to choose between Washington and Beijing, noting that many regional partnerships with the U.S. are older than the Chinese Communist Party. He even held out what sounded like an olive branch to China, asking to work together in areas like climate change.
We will not flinch when our interests are threatened, yet we do not seek confrontation. So let me be clear. As Secretary, I am committed to pursuing a constructive, stable relationship with China.
Experts warn pursuing a stable relationship may be the best way to try to de-escalate tensions, which are approaching all-time highs on issues ranging from Taiwan to the South China Sea. Carla Babb, VOA News, Singapore.
And finally, the Tokyo Olympics brought some unexpected gold medals for countries and teams which rarely, if ever, had athletes on the podium. The AP's Ed Donahue rounds us out.
Other than 1980, the Philippines has been in the Summer Olympics since 1924. In Tokyo, the Philippines won its first gold medal.
I did not give up, and my team did not give up.
5 foot 2 inches tall, Heidelin Diaz won gold for the Philippines in the 55 kilo, over 202-pound weightlifting.
We can, and I know they are proud to be Filipino.
Flora Duffy has won the Olympic women's triathlon, earning Bermuda's first Olympic gold medal.
To be Olympic champion has sort of been my dream since I was a pretty little girl when I first did my first triathlon.
Duffy says this is bigger than just her.
Competing on the world stage from a small island is really possible.
Duffy is one of just two athletes representing Bermuda in Tokyo. I'm Ed Donahue.
And this has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, Thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. Just visit our website at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.